Hi, everyone. It's Janice, host of the Divorcing Religion podcast. Thanks for tuning into my show, whether you're joining me on audio or video. I've heard from some folks recently who have told me just how much the show has meant, and some of them have even found it not only to be life-changing, but life-saving, as they felt there was no one else who understood what they were going through, and they found the Divorcing Religion podcast, and they started feeling encouraged. Please help me keep my show on the air. Become a member by clicking the join button on the Conference on Religious Trauma YouTube channel. Thanks. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. I'm a registered professional counselor and a religious recovery consultant. I'm so pleased to have my guest joining me again today on the Divorcing Religion podcast. I have Seth Andrews. Seth is a former evangelical and Christian broadcaster who now hosts The Thinking Atheist, one of the most popular podcasts and online atheist communities in the world. The Thinking Atheist is not a person. It is an icon, encouraging all to reject faith and pursue reason and evidence. Seth has authored 5 books, including his latest, Christianity Made Me Talk Like an Idiot. I'm raising my hand for those who can't see. He also hosts a second podcast, True Stories with Seth Andrews. Seth, it's so nice to see you again. Welcome.
I wish I'd had the Divorcing Religion podcast when I was deconstructing. It's funny how few resources were available 15 some years ago. We were scrambling. I think we had Atheist Nexus online. There was just a lot of very data-heavy websites, but the storytelling of deconstruction wasn't around really very much. So I listened to your work, and I talked to, you know, Gail and Daryl Ray and up at Recovering from Religion, and I'm always like, man, if only you had been there when I was doing those sleepless nights, staring at the ceiling, my stomach in a knot, wondering who I was and what the future held, and everything was either collapsing or emerging. I couldn't really tell what was going on. So when I hear you say the Divorcing Religion podcast, I'm like, yes, you are here now for other people who need you. I think that's very cool. So
thank you so much. And I totally agree, because when I first lost my faith, I was shocked. I didn't expect to. I wasn't on a journey where I was like exploring other things. It's like I was very religious. And then there was a series of calamities that made me go, wow, I think I've bet on the wrong horse. But I didn't move immediately into atheist mode. It took me a while. So I'm sitting at the computer, you know, 14 years ago. I don't even know what to type into the computer, like, help, I lost my faith. I just didn't even have the words for it. Deconstruction wasn't a word we were throwing around back then. And so for me, I kind of wandered around by myself until I ran into Dr. Marlene Winnell on the internet and saw Marlene doing an interview, and she talked about religious trauma. And I thought, oh yeah, that is exactly what I could relate to.
It's funny. And I'll have people, it's usually loaded, or maybe it's just that they don't realize they're phrasing it this way, but they'll be like, well, when did you decide you didn't believe in God? And I always have to stop them and say, I didn't decide. I didn't wake up one day and say, well, I will now not believe in any gods. I just admitted to myself what had happened organically. Well, you know, when did you choose to become an atheist? Well, I didn't choose it. I didn't wake up and say, today I would like to undo decades of my own life. I would like to turn my back on beliefs I once held dear. I would like to put myself on the bubble with my entire social circle and then, you know, put a big question mark on my entire future at midlife. I didn't decide to do that. I just simply had to acknowledge that it had already happened. And I think that's the truth with a lot of people. You don't wake up and say, I'm going to turn my life upside down or right side up. You simply realize this is going on. How am I going to deal with it? And for those who can, I encourage you to deal with it head on. It's often difficult, but boy, there's nothing like being an authentic person and doing it your way instead of listening to everybody else all the time, doing it their way to keep them comfortable. You know, keep asking the questions. And the weirder it gets, it might be telling you something, you know. You know, maybe it all sounds weird for a reason. Maybe you're onto something. Keep digging. You never know what you're going to find. So
yeah, and I remember kind of feeling like I was a mental pretzel trying to twist myself into all these different modes of thinking to make the Bible fit reality. And I just eventually could not do it and figured out, well, something's got to give here. This, I can't go on if this isn't correct, because I wanted to live my life according to truth. And so then I realized I was going to have to do some more digging outside what I'd been told was the truth. And that was the only frame I had.
And, you know, religions like Christianity have had thousands of years to evolve really powerful defense mechanisms to keep you inside, to keep you from leaving, whether it's threats of hell, right? That's sort of you're scared of burning forever, whether it's losing your social circle, whether it is being cast off or judged. You might lose your job if your boss is a believer. There are all of these sort of social in-group defense mechanisms designed to reinforce what they do and keep you from kicking the tires and tapping on the glass. And so, you know, when people tell me that they did emerge or they're on a journey, I high-five them and say, what you are doing or what you have done is so courageous. Many people never get there. Give yourself credit for doing some heavy lifting and taking some risks, because it's not always easy. And, you know, I'm trying to be a little bit of a cheerleader. I know you do the same, Janice, you know, go team. Yeah. You know, we can do it. Yes, we can, kind of thing. So,
And so then you were a Christian broadcaster. So your life, your beliefs and your career were all tied in together. And so if you could even just give us a little reminder, I know lots of people are already familiar with your story, but just how did you get from there to here? Because, well, now you have like the most popular, amazing atheist show in the world. It's like, that's a pretty big step.
If you'd have come to me 17 years ago and said this was going to be where I would be, I would just have blinked at you, right? My mother and father, theologian level believers. My home was probably more fundy than most. They met at Oral Roberts University. They honeymooned in the Holy Lands. They wrote sermons for pastors. My mother wrote a Greek New Testament study guide. They were very much these sort of intellectual partners. And so there was no religious small talk. It was, everything was Christian. Christian shows, Christian school, Christian media, Christian friends. Talk about reinforcers. And so I hadn't really been properly introduced to the outside world. We didn't know what evolution was. We just knew it was wrong. We'd never read the works of Darwin. We just knew he was an idiot or an agent of the devil. And and that's what they do, right? They teach you to sort of scoff and huff and dismiss and then retreat back into the safe cocoon in which you are raised, where everything is simple and familiar. And so I had an affinity for Christian music growing up. It was the soundtrack of my youth. I was listening. I was buying the cassettes and the records, Amy Grant and Michael W. Smith and Whiteheart, et cetera. And
Petra.
I was there second row for the Petra Not in This World tour. Oh, yeah, you know, I'm rocking for Jesus.
Striper. And I got thrown Striper.
Striper. I saw Stripers to Hell with the Devil tour at the Old Lady on Brady Theater. You know, I'm standing right in front of the speaker with my eardrum rattling as they're throwing little Striper Bibles into the audience. I mean, it was crazy circus, Janice. But I translated my love for the industry, because we really felt like David in the David and Goliath model, right? The big secular music behemoths, they were well-funded and slick and popular. We were the underdogs. We were sort of doing it on a shoestring and one day, you know, but we were going to go out and do good music for Jesus. So we really forgave a lot of the you know, there were a lot of seams. You know, there were a lot of, it was a work in progress. And, but I just loved it. And so when I was in school, I was sort of a natural communicator, student leader, blah, 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 big mouth, essentially. And when my voice changed, it changed to the point where it sounded kind of like it does now, is kind of a broadcaster's voice. And so radio, Christian radio, seemed like the right fit. I spent 12 years in the business. I did a couple of years in pop radio after that, left radio full-time in 2008 to go to work as a video producer, and I traveled all around the country shooting mostly fundraising videos for churches, hundreds of churches. And the whole time I'm shooting these videos, I'm wrestling in the back of my mind with so many questions that, you know, the answers that they're giving me are not working. And so I was going through this sort of thing in the background, and the noise, the alarms were getting louder and louder and louder. And I don't know if it was midlife or I just got fed up with being afraid. I don't know why, but in my mid-30s, I finally thought, all right, fine. All right, I'm going to figure this out. And I'd stumbled upon a Christopher Hitchens debate video, and I found him strangely impressive. I wasn't supposed to find him impressive because he was the atheist, but he was making a lot of sense. And before I knew it, I went on this sort of pilgrimage, came out the other side and realized that it didn't make any sense. And because there weren't many resources back then, I decided to start a website, YouTube channel, and try to be a part of the conversation. And maybe if I was lucky, to build some kind of community for other people. We started the website, let's see, 2009, so that's 15 years, and then the podcast 2010, so that's almost 14 years. So, I've been, you know, it's been amazing. I can't believe I'm still doing it, but sadly, it's kind of necessary, you know? I look around at this crazy world and go, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to be out of a job anytime soon, right?
Whatever. Yeah, I mean, I got to say, and I think I can speak for a majority of Canadians when I ask, what the hell is going on in your country right now? There's a lot of craziness that's happening, and certainly we see with the buildup to the election. And I mean, I'm waking up in a cold sweat sometimes. I'm having nightmares about your country, about the election and everything that's going on there. I cannot even imagine the stress that so many of you are feeling right now. And it's just raw. Emotions are raw. You're the United States, and it doesn't feel so united right now.
Not remotely. We're apparently two warring nations. You know, I always knew that the zealots were out there. Mm-hmm. Hell, I used to be one to a degree. I wasn't anything like what I'm seeing now, even when I was devout. People will ask me, well, what caused this zealotry, this Christian nationalist uprising, the cult of Trump? You know, I think they want a binary answer. You know, they want to put it on a bumper sticker, and I don't think life works that way. I know people who are highly intelligent who have somehow talked themselves into, well, the Lord sometimes uses flawed people, as he did with King Cyrus. And so therefore, you know, Trump may be a horrible human being, but he's a tool in God's toolkit somehow. Or maybe they're single issue voters. So Trump switches his position on reproductive rights conveniently before the 2016 election. Oh, wow, he's pro-life. That's all I need to hear. One issue then becomes a blanket vote for a man who is so many horrible things. You find fundamentalist religions prime members for authority figures, for savior. If you look at Christianity, and you know this, Christianity is an authoritarian model. Mm-hmm. You respond to an absolute authority. The word obedience, obey, it's littered throughout Scripture. Turn off your brain, line up, support your guy, do what he says, and that's God's will. And so if somebody comes along, and we've seen people, we've seen despots and autocrats and totalitarians and dictators and oppressors and tyrants throughout history invoke the name of God and say, don't question me. I'm not here. It's not my idea that I am king. I am anointed and appointed by God. And there's a culture of people primed to respond to kings, proxies for God, savior figures. Trump is what, if not a savior figure? Mm-hmm. I have come to save you. During the 2016 campaign, he said, I alone can fix it. And people cheered. Well, why would you cheer such an obviously hyperbolic statement? Because you're primed. You're primed for saviors. And I think Trump has been kind of a blacklight on much of the worst of us. Mm-hmm. White privilege, the racial tensions and societal unrest, class systems and all kinds of problems. And I look around and I see really, I don't think I'm being a binary thinker when I feel like I'm seeing one camp that is willing to sacrifice democracy to get what they want and to hold on to power. And I see another group of people who are saying, there's room in the world for all of us, right? There's room for everybody. We don't want to take away your faith. We don't want to close your church. We don't want to strip away your Bibles. We're not going to make your religion illegal. All of the fear fiction that has been sold over here is total crap. We're just saying we want equal treatment. We want compassion. We want to do away with cruelty. We want to try to build a better world. There is a place at the table for everyone. That's the camp that I'm rooting for.
As
the other camp has managed to co-opt the school boards and the Congress and the courts and for a while the White House, I don't know what's going to happen. I was telling Natalie, forgive me, I'm babbling, Janice, but
please continue.
we were sitting up last night. It was last night. We were kind of talking about it, and she's a little worried about me because she knows that if Trump wins the 2024 presidential election, I think she knows how devastating it will be to a great many people. Me being an activist, I tend to, you know, I go to 11. And I said, you know, honey, I am holding on to my hope. I'm not going to give up my hope. I'm going to work as hard as I've ever worked toward hope. But I can't help but feel like I am about to bear witness to the decline and fall of Western democracy or American democracy. And I don't think that's hyperbole. What happens in the next however many months is it may determine whether or not we remain a democracy or whether it just becomes a straight up autocracy. It becomes, you know, we toss the Constitution. We say, put one guy in charge, give him immunity. He's already begging for immunity. I should have immunity in everything I do. I will be a day one dictator. And people cheer. Yay. I never thought I'd live in that world. People hear the word dictator and say, yay.
It's outrageous. Yeah. It really is. And it's outrageous. So much the, it does tie in with fundamentalists. And I'm thinking of Christianity, but I guess, you know, Abrahamic fundamentalists who are desperate for a strong man. And there's so much fear there, fear of the unknown, fear of other people, fear of people who don't look like me or talk like me. Oh my God, the gullibility factor that seems to be there is just, it's really something to witness.
We talked a lot, you know, about why do even many smart people fall for conspiracy theories? Mm-hmm. Who was I talking to about this on the show? And I'm like, well, I see the Christian story as written about in the Bible is a conspiracy theory. It's mm-hmm. a story of conspiracy. You've got a master plan. You've got a sinister agent who is then ousted. And then he dedicates the whole of his life to trying to infiltrate and destroy. You've got good agents and bad agents and everybody in between. And it's, you know, we're building toward a big climax. If you look at the Christian holy book, it essentially spins a conspiracy theory. I'm also struck by so many believers who they will say, give you lip service that they are divinely protected. No weapon formed against me shall prosper, right?
Oh, dear.
God has counted. He knows how many hairs are on my head. He knows when a sparrow falls from the sky. Am I not worth more than many sparrows, as written about in the book of Matthew? I am divinely protected. And then they spend their whole day just terrified. Everybody's coming for them. The immigrants are coming for them, and the LGBT people are coming for them, and the trans people are, and the drag queens are coming for them, and the socialists are coming for them, and the COVID vaccine. I mean, everything's coming for them. And I think for people who are divinely protected, you just live in the constant mode of freak out. You do not strike me as someone who lives in confidence whatsoever. I find that interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And I agree with you on the whole conspiracy element of Christianity. And certainly we recognize that people really crave certainty, security, order, and acceptance. And religion ties those up in a bow, as do conspiracy theories. So for a lot of people who fall down the conspiracy rabbit holes, this may be the first time in their life that they feel accepted by a community. They're being love bombed in that community. Lots of people have actually never even been to church in this day and age. So they haven't had that sense of community, but they are offered a sense of community in the conspiracy groups. And they then feel that they have the secret sauce. They know the magic, which of course religions believe their way is the right way as well. And it gives them a way to order their world, to understand their world and interpret the world in a way that makes sense to them and makes them feel safe. So we're ripe for all of it. I think just the evolution, whatever's gone on in our brain, we have a glitch that's easily hijacked by religion and conspiracy theories.
I was talking to David McRaney, who is author of the book, How Minds Change. And you and I were speaking a second ago about the in-group, out-group penalties. You know, if you betray the tribe, then it's going to get bad for you. And he told the story of a 9/11 truther. He used to believe that, you know, it was all a big conspiracy and the government was behind it and false flags and Building 7 and thermite and crisis actors, the whole thing. And there's a whole community, right? Just what you're speaking about. They get together, they validate and reinforce each other. There's a social cohesion and bonding, a strength, a security, a structure of that, a sense of family with an in-group that knows more than everybody else. And he was at one point taken out and shown the site, and he was given the chance to meet many of the families of some of the 9/11 victims and shown the evidence of what happened on that day. And when it was all over, he realized, no, this was a real thing. It did happen in real life. And he went back to his group and he said, I've changed my mind on this. I no longer believe that it was a false flag, that it's a setup. I'm now convinced that over here, this data is accurate and it actually happened. And his group not only kicked him out and turned on him and vilified him, but they posted like photos of his altered photos of his children on the internet and went after him personally, trying to destroy his life, to discredit him for all time. When people face those types of consequences, we can understand why, for many, it's easier just to zip your lip, even if you doubt or disbelieve, just to decide it ain't worth it, right? It's not just me, it's my family, it's my livelihood, it's where I live, it's what I do, it's how I'm going to get along in this crazy world. Now, you can understand how a lot of people are like, no, it's not worth it for me. And this can be true in any high-control culture, whether it's a conspiracy culture or whether it's a high-control religious or cult, you know, culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I look at the just the wonderful people, the volunteers that really keep your nation and my nation running. And I'm thinking of volunteers who work at elections offices and voting places and people who serve on their city council and their school board. And the things have been ratcheted up and the heat has been turned up so much that people are terrifying these people. They're threatening them. It's a scary thing. I wouldn't have thought it would take a lot of courage to be someone working at a voting station, but now I think differently.
Well, it doesn't help that we live in a nation that has more firearms than citizens. There are almost 400 million firearms in the United States as people continue to say we need more guns, right? There's a gun show every quarter in my hometown, billboards, gun show, gun show, gun show. We have, as a nation, equated firearms with freedom. If you come after my firearm or try to regulate my firearm, you are attacking my freedom. Don't tread on me. You're not going to take away my American liberties. And so the God and guns crowd is now so ramped up against the rhetoric or under the rhetoric of people like Donald Trump, that more and more people are convinced that this might be a physical uprising. What happens if they believe that America has been stripped away or it has been diminished? True America, God's America, one nation under God is under attack. They have been primed to think, well, maybe it's not just a metaphorical war. Maybe this is war. Maybe we're going to have to go out and pull some triggers. And I am very concerned that we are going to see January 6th in pockets all around the United States. I have a feeling all Trump has to do is say one word, All he has to do is say, you know, go. And there's a culture of people that are going to, they're going to be bullets in the streets. I don't think that's exaggeration. I really do think that they will see themselves as literal holy warriors, nobly taking their country back by force. And that to me, that's another reason why I wonder if maybe democracy really is on the bubble. Maybe we're looking at sort of, maybe we're circling the drain. Maybe I'm going to need asylum up there. Mm-hmm. And so I'll call you, Janice.
I'm over here.
You got room on your couch. Natalie and I, you know, we'll split it. The dogs fit really easy.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Wow. Yeah. It is concerning. And we were glued to the TV for the January 6th committee. Every time they showed up and shared their findings, we just thought that took such tremendous courage when those politicians came together, especially for the Republican ones who actually were willing to sit on this committee and tell the truth. And what I think when we're talking about people having they feel the need to take up arms, that is fundamentalism, extremism, radicalism. When our identity and our ideology merge, they become merged with each other. And so anybody raising a question about our ideology becomes a threat to us, to our identity. And this is what we have seen happening in the Trump cult, just like we've seen forever in religious communities. It's not just, I believe this, it's, I am this.
Well, what's weird is that here in the United States, there are millions and millions and millions of our citizens who haven't seen 60 seconds of January 6th footage. It happened. It's one of the biggest news events of the new millennium. And it's not just that they haven't seen it, but they have not seen it. They do not want to see it. And they are convinced that the reason that they should not see it is because it's all trumped up. It's exaggerated. It's been incorrectly or deceptively edited. It was Antifa, false flag, the government, a tourist visit, a plot by the Democrats. They have already decided we are a closed system. We are not interested. How can you not be interested in an event of that magnitude? It really kills a part of the heart. And it's something we are not going to over. Trump could get hit by a satellite. It could fall out of the sky on Trump's motorcade tomorrow, right? And he's out of the equation. But the culture that brought him to power and celebrated the things that he stood and continues to stand for, those people will remain. We're not going to be out of the woods, I don't think, for decades. If we survive it, it is going to take decades to recover from what we are going through right now. I don't even know if we'll see it in my lifetime, but I certainly do hope we survive. And I'm going to keep kicking and trying to play any kind of part as best I can for what it's worth.
Exactly. And I love that you use your platform in such a powerful way to encourage people. You really are encouraging people to be reasonable. So stop relying on faith and what people tell you. You know, be looking for actual evidence, not just YouTube evidence. But we do see around the world, so many countries appear to be falling into dictatorships. That's right, dictatorships. And one of the elements, I think it's definitely at play, and we see it in the United States, is people fleeing unstable countries. And it may be climate change, it may be war, it's often religious war. And they are, and of course, drug issues as well, threatening their safety. People are clamoring to get into safe countries. And it feels overwhelming. I'm thinking particularly of some of the smaller nations in Europe and so forth. And I think, what can we do? How can we adapt? Because we're all human. This planet is it for us. This is our home. We can't just fly away to Mars, not just yet. So we have better figure out how to get along and how to manage things so that there is room for everybody, that we should have enough food for everybody. It's not a crisis in that sense. There is enough for everybody, but it's, you know, a dozen people or whatever, 100 people around the world that have most of the money.
I think too, in the United States, there's this, it's the myth of rugged individualism. Part of the American identity is, All you have to do is work hard and take risks and dedicate yourself. And the world is your oyster. You know, you can be anything you want to be. Just work hard, pray hard, and America will open up to you. And that's what they tell people.
That's the fantasy.
And it sounds great, you know, in a commercial, in a jingle. Right? Oh, yeah. And there are some people who have been very fortunate, who are people who have taken risks and had an immense amount of talent and managed to overcome a tremendously disadvantaged backdrop to achieve great things. Good for them. But they didn't do it on their own. And there is the lie that a true American is an individual only, that, you know, the society shouldn't have much to do with who you are or what opportunities are presented. And so this is a very easy way to take people who are marginalized groups, minority groups, groups that are discriminated against, and say, well, if you know you're still poor, or if you haven't been successful, it's not my problem, it's your problem. You haven't been dedicated enough, or you're not working hard enough. This is America. All you have to do is try. You can be whatever you want to be. It's a way of sort of blaming the victim. Mm-hmm. And I wish we had more a sense of collectivist values in this country.
Yes.
That we can celebrate individuals, but nobody gets there alone. Right. Elon Musk did not get there alone. Bill Gates did not get there alone. Steve Jobs did not get, Warren Buffett did not get there. I mean, I just think there's this idea that one boy or girl genius goes out and does it the American way or whatever, and they reap the whirlwind. That's actually, reap the whirlwind is a bad metaphor. That's bad.
That's right.
They reap the benefits.
Yeah.
They reap the benefits. And it's all about them. And so, you know, but again, that's reductive thinking. If we were less about me and more about all of us, I think we could sure solve a lot of problems. Sadly, I don't think selfishness as a human trait is going to go away anytime soon.
I think you're exactly right. I love that phrase, together we rise. There's something so beautiful about that. And yet, having grown up in an individualistic culture in Canada, it's easy for me to pass judgment on collectivist cultures and think, oh, you know, there's no individuality or whatever I tell myself about it. But boy, oh boy, they are doing a lot of things right. They understand about supporting each other, supporting family, being there for each other. And I feel like that's what's missing. That's a big piece of what's missing. I want to talk about someone who is one of the very rich, rich people. Our Lord and Savior, Taylor Swift. She's just so sweet. And she's very philanthropic. And she's a brilliant marketer. And I love learning about all the different ways that she is behind the scenes helping people. That's so beautiful to me. And I love that she managed to get a whole bunch of voters registered for the last election and really encouraged people that way. And so I guess it's not too surprising that the MAGA crowd, quite a few of them or some of them, were talking about it's a conspiracy. Taylor Swift, this is part of a conspiracy.
Go figure.
I chuckled.
I've come to the point, I said a while back that I've come to the point in my life where I think it's immoral to be a billionaire. How many thousands of millions does one person need in a world filled with so much suffering? If I was going to make an exception, I'd make it for Taylor. Because here's what I like about her. And I'm not a Swiftie, but you know, Natalie likes a lot of her music and I'll hear it. But I've seen documentaries about her and followed up on her story, especially after all of the media accounts. And what I don't see is some sort of an airbrushed studio creation, just another American Idol, you know, product of marketing. There is always going to be some of that, but I see somebody with a tremendous amount of organic, natural talent who writes her own songs, who sets a tremendously strong and positive example for young women, for women across the board, and for men. Who is not afraid to, you know, she bravely came forward and started to speak to her values, even if being political might cost her support and put her in the MAGA crosshairs. And she brings a ton of joy to the world. So, you know, the hipsters are always like, man, her music sucks, or she always sings about her breakups. So they're always finding ways to sort of discount her. But I'm like, why would you care? What she does organically. When she's not handed a song and said, all right, here's your next hit. She's saying, I've written a song. Here's my next hit. She is organically creating songs, music. She is running her own show. She's a monumentally savvy business person. She gives generously to everybody who is in her circle on the tour, etc. I just find her impressive. And the more she triggers these tissue-skinned alpha male types out there, you know, just I don't know if they're threatened because she's female or because they wish she was in our camp, but she sure isn't. So I guess we're going to destroy her. You know, the more I see that, the more I smile and say, oh, you know what? The best medicine, the best revenge is just be good and be successful. It's just a win, you know? And I hope she wins. I hope she continues to be successful. I have no reason to root for anything other than just good things for her. So what I've seen, I've been impressed by.
I like that so much. Yes, boy, I wish I knew her. She just seems delightful. I did see, I think on your website, I was going through some of your interviews, and you shared time with a woman who I think is a Baptist. And so, because we were talking about MAGA and there's so much evangelical, unfortunately, support for Trump. But I want to also remind people that not all, sorry to say, not all Christians, I know people don't like to hear that, but not everyone does think that way. There are lots of people who still count themselves as Christian people who detest what is going on politically in your country these days.
And that needs to be said. Mm-hmm. There is a culture of skeptics, atheists, freethinkers, humanists, I don't know, whatever. People in my camp, in our camp, and they're like, well, if you call yourself a Christian, even if you don't want to discriminate, and even if you've distanced yourself from the fundamentals and you don't need a Bible and yours is this personal relationship with a Christ who would never judge anybody and who loves LGBT people and would never send anybody to hell, you're the best person in the world, but you still call yourself a Christian? Well, you're still announcing that you are in league with these people who call themselves Christians, and they want to strip away all that is good and decent and moral and whatnot. And so you're guilty by association. It's again, it's reductive and it's binary. And a lot of people, I've been pounding this drum for a few years. I'm surrounded in my life by many God believers, beautiful, wonderful people. They do not fit in one of those memes about mental illness or, I mean, some of the most horrible things that are said about religious people. I think they're good in, despite their faith. Yeah, I don't think they need their faith to be good. I think they're just good people. And we have theological disagreements, but they would give you the shirt off their back. They are just lovely, centered people. They just happen to believe in God. And I was, you know, I've come to the point where I just think we are not going to have success if we spend all of our time finding reasons to not have allies in this fight. If we have all of these sort of qualifiers and we gatekeep everybody who has a disagreement here and we say, no, you don't get to. Well, we're not going to change the world that way. There are a lot of Christians. Amanda Tyler, Baptist Joint Committee, who founded Christians Against Christian Nationalism, a devout Baptist. She and I disagree on theology. We agree on values and state church separation. She is a lovely, wonderful human being. Dr. Robert P. Jones, he is a Christian and a statistician and a sociologist and an author. We disagree on the Bible. We agree on people. He and I are shoulder to shoulder allies in this way. Rachel Lazar at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. She has a Jewish faith. We may disagree on the Jewish religion, but we are allies. We are absolutely on the same side when it comes to protecting and defending democracy and the safety and equality of our fellow human beings. For some people, they think this is impossible or it's some kind of a sellout. And I encourage those people, open the umbrella further. You've got to expand that tent. We see human beings in terms of our values first. And if we do that, if we can join together in what I will call, for lack of a better word, interfaith efforts, that's, I think, when we're going to have real power. It also, I think, takes the teeth out of some of the complaints that, well, it's just the godless who want to strip God out of our culture. Well, if I'm standing next to Amanda Tyler of the Baptist Joint Committee, who will fight to the death, I'm sure, for her right to believe personally in the Christian God, well, it's a whole lot harder to make that argument, because Amanda's like, no, I'd never work to have my religion taken away. I simply don't want to stay church. And there's a big difference. We've got to stop scanning the horizon, eager for disqualifiers, trying to go it alone. We're not going to be successful if we do that.
Oh, yeah. And you used a word that I just love. You mentioned values. And I know when I'm working with clients who have, say, they married when they were young and very devout Christians, and now one of them is no longer Christian, is no longer religious at all. And then there comes a tremendous concern within the couple about the marriage, because their faith was what brought them together. It was their purpose. It was their focus. And when I'm working with these couples, I remind them that now we must shift to our shared values, because we no longer share the beliefs, but we surely do share the values of loving our children, loving our neighbor, you know, valuing truth and kindness and compassion. Christians may call it mercy. So we still share so many values. And I think when you're talking about reaching across the aisle, essentially, to people that we don't share beliefs with, we have to have that focus on our common values as human beings. And in your case, as citizens of the United States, over here, citizens of Canada, I'd love to see us get to that point. And I think also that will have to be a motivation for, we see people starving in other parts of the world, or they're in a war-ravaged nation, not to say, well, I'm not going to help them because they don't believe the same as me. First of all, let's see that they are human. These are people who are suffering. How can we help to alleviate the suffering?
Or to me, they're that's not what in our Jesus social would do. Right? Yeah, I mean, I came out of that whole, well, America first. I'm going to solve the problems here before I give a care about what's happening over there. Those people, right? Mm-hmm. And I just feel like we don't need ourselves to lose for others to win. We don't have to take away from us to be able to benefit someone else. And at least in so many cases. And I just resist that kind of in-group tribal othering. Mm-hmm. Somehow we're better, we're more important. For what? For what is so often an accident of birth. Oh, I popped out on this date and this geographic point so many years ago, and so now this is my tribe. Well, and that seems like a weird identity to have. Mm-hmm. How about an identity as a human being and what we proactively want to build and create as human beings together? That seems like a better starting point for sure.
Oh, totally. And yet I feel like that we have to fight against the training we had if we grew up in fundamentalist homes and communities, which is absolutely in-group, out-group, binary, rigid, authoritarian. You're either in the club or you're out of the club. So we're kind of fighting against that. And it can be hard. Even after we've left religion, we can be years out of it and still have that fundamentalist struggle in our mind.
Jana, it's a human thing. We evolved as tribal. In the atheist culture, people are like, you know, they try to talk like they're immune to all of these flaws, these, you know, the less attractive parts of the evolved person. And they're like, well, you know, but then they talk about the religious as if they're all one thing, billions of people. And you're like, well, they do this. Christians think that. Islam does that. You know, Muslims are. And they do that with each other. They find opportunity. They find excuses to other people inside their own camp who may not be ideologically pure, or they have a disagreement, or somebody made a mistake, which is what humans do. And so they decide, oh, now you're part of the out group. So we're going to throw you over the wall, and then we're going to throw rocks at you from a distance, and we're going to destroy you. I mean, tribalism is a human thing. And I think the first defense, and maybe the best defense we have against it, is to simply be aware of it, to understand we are not immune. Rationalists aren't immune. Really, really, really intelligent in people. People are not immune. You know, everybody can be guilty. And tribes have their benefits, and they can be amazing, and they can be great ways to have community and get things done in this world. But then, you know, once we start to spill into that sort of toxic othering, I think we must be aware that it's happening and just stop ourselves right there and say no further, no further.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. And then it also brings to mind cancel culture, which we don't actually hear too much about these days, or not as much as we did. But to me, that is also such a springs from a fundamentalist kind of outlook on life. Okay, you don't believe or you say something I don't like, so I'm going to cancel you, rather than let's have a dialogue about this thing that we fundamentally disagree on. Maybe I can learn a little bit about where you're coming from. You can learn about where I'm coming from. If we cancel people and cut them off altogether, there's never the opportunity for that dialogue to happen. And frankly, it even when we do learn something new, we might have to regroup for a little bit and stop and think about it, because often then, like the person you talked about at the beginning, when he realized that 9/11 actually did happen, then when he went to his group and said to them, you know what, I've been wrong, he had a huge price to pay. So it might take people a little bit of time to figure out how they can best talk to their group about this, the fact that they were wrong. So I'm not a big fan of the whole cancel culture thing. I really would prefer that we could talk with each other.
I think it's situational too. I think it's a case by case. If someone says or does something genuinely awful and destructive, I think if a platform doesn't want to be associated with that, they have every right to say, well, there's going to be a consequence to what you have just said and done. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a problem with consequence culture.
Yes,
Find there is a bad apple, or somebody who is simply so wrongheaded that they're doing something genuinely destructive, and you don't want them to be a part of your mission, vision, organization, and you make that decision, I support that. Hell, I've been part of organizations that had to make those types of difficult decisions with key people in the past, and it's hard, but I get it. But speaking to your point, especially in the age of the keyboard warrior internet, talk about binary, you know, where we're talking in 280 characters, we are so quick to declare war, to say, oh, you're wrong about this. Well, if you're wrong, you're bad. If you're bad, you're garbage. If you're garbage, you have to be thrown out. People are far, far too eager. When someone, and they may be genuinely wrong, does being wrong make them a horrible human being, someone who needs to be crushed under our boot? Are they someone to be held in absolute disgust and disdain? Or are they just wrong about an issue, and we should be sitting down and having good faith conversations to try to figure it out? And at the end, if we disagree, is that person still the devil? Or do we just think, well, I don't hold to your position. I think you're wrong here. And this is a big one, but I know you're a good person. Let's continue dialogue. I don't see nearly enough of that in this world. Mm-hmm. And I worry that it's going to get worse as our interactions, especially on the internet, really aren't about engagement. It's about trying to win, right?
Yeah.
It's not about understanding. It's not. I've been going. Here's another long winder. I'm sorry. But I have been working on it in my own, not with the hard targets. I mean, I'll throw my snark out there when it comes to the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Ben Shapiros and whatnot. Yeah, the hard targets have it coming. Mm-hmm. But in the everydays, when somebody comes in and says something and they throw out the ad hom, they say something that's, you know, it's easy meat. I could go in there and take that bait, and I could do something really fun with it and turn that screw and stir the pot. And I'm going to come off looking pretty good, I'm convinced. I've gone through in the last several years an exercise where I pause and I say, what could I say or do here that would be kind of unimpeachable? If you could go in and ask a question or to say, well, I'm not sure I understand your position here. I appreciate you coming and sharing what you think. We don't align in this way. Like literally having, I had a guy come on my page months ago. I'd said something that he disagreed with and he was like, oh, well, nice virtue signaling, pal. And I knew who he was and I admired him. And instead of coming back and saying, oh, yeah, screw you, I'm no longer a fan, I'm going to go unlike everything you've ever done, I went in and I said, oh, hey, man. Yeah, well, here's kind of what I was thinking and why I said that. And I really think that that's how I feel about it. By the way, I love your work. I followed you for years and I think you're fantastic. And I just wanted you to know that, you know, we may disagree here, but I'm going to keep following everything you do. And I appreciate you so much. And I waited. And within an hour, I got a reply. And instead of, hey, screw you, or I'm going to unfriend or unfollow you, or I'm going to screen cap the whole conversation and show it to my people so I can look awesome. He didn't do any of that. He came back and he's like, hey, thanks for that. You know, and I just want you to know kind of where I'm at. Total de-escalation. And we're friends today.
Beautiful.
And that's a force of will. I mean, it's hard to do that. Yeah. But to take that breath, it's become kind of an exercise and a challenge I've issued myself. And if you follow my pages, you'll see me throw out the snark, but you'll also see me say, hey, everybody, don't pile on to this guy. You know, he came in, he said something kind of awful, but, you know, let's not make it worse. Let's just move on with our day. It's all good. And that's uncommon in the internet. So I'm trying it. We'll see what happens.
I love it. Yeah. My husband, Paul, he often says, be hard on issues and gentle on people. And I just think that it's so wise and so beautiful. And
unless
I
it's
really
Ben Shapiro or Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, you know.
I'm sorry. Even I have limits, Jen. I'm a nice guy. I'm the Mr. Rogers of the movement. But I swear to you. But I totally understand. Yeah, we go hard at ideas. It's like when I go after Islam and they call me an Islamophobe.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, well, no, I'm not going, I'm not phobic, and I'm not coming after a person. Mm-hmm. It's not a racist thing because Islam is not a race. You can be any race and be a Muslim. It is an idea, and ideas are fair game. I'm going to go for the ideas. Let's tackle those and do our best to try and treat people with respect. And there's a way, I think, to divide those sort of angles of attack. It gets messy sometimes, but I think that it's certainly something we should be working on.
Well, and as a result, you got interviewed by Al Jazeera. Oh my God, you know you're somebody when Al Jazeera is coming. They want to do an interview with you, and it was so good.
It was Al Jazeera English. Now, when I saw Al Jazeera, I had to do my own homework because I'm like, okay, well, this is Qatar, and what's going on here? But Al Jazeera English is an interesting phenomenon. It's a largely really fair media outlet. They may, you know, they may mitigate, they may massage just a little bit when it comes to, you know, the Middle East and whatnot. But overall, when it comes to media fairness, they are actually rated really highly. And that surprised me. And that's the reason I agreed when they reached out and said, we'd like to do a profile of some YouTube atheists and the movement and the culture. Would you agree to have someone come out to your home and have a conversation? I was like,
wow,
let me check you out. And so I did some reading, did my due diligence. And I said, oh, fine, I'd be honored. Come out. And went on camera. And they produced a 9-minute profile of YouTube atheists.
Oh, it was wonderful. And I saw another friend, Chrissy Stroop, on there as well. And I love Chrissy's writing. She's so knowledgeable. And I just really appreciate a lot
freaking
of the
genius.
Things that
she's so smart.
She really is smart.
Yeah. I just want to get smarter by osmosis.
I know.
Like, all right, Chrissy, sit here. I just want to get smarter just by being in a proximity. That's, I'd like to meet her in person one day for that reason. But yeah, well, the vibe of the piece was, it was a little bit reductive and they made a few mistakes. First of all, the producer was talking about the atheist world of you. That was a reference that came out a couple of times. And I actually sent him an email and I said, lovely piece, but atheism is not a world of you. You know, I do not believe in unicorns. I do not believe in the tooth fairy. I do not believe in apparitions. That's not a world of you, right? Mm-hmm. I do not believe in gods is not a world of you. And I always have to make that distinction. It doesn't necessarily dictate anything else. It might, not believing in gods may open the doors to better understanding the world and using that understanding to know what our values are, to choose our positions politically, et cetera. So, I mean, it may be a little bit of a gateway, but atheism is not a worldview. But overall, it was talking about how it used to be just all fire and just slams and punch words and shouting. And we realized, finally, we got smart and realized that when it comes to identity beliefs, telling people that they're idiots or that they're just screaming, you're wrong, here's the data, we have the science, we win. We used to think walking into the room with a bunch of bullet points was gonna get it done. And instead, the opposite happened. And our interlocutors got defensive and felt attacked and doubled down and either attacked us or ran scrambling to somewhere where they felt more safe. We weren't getting any traction. We have really begun to better understand how the brain works. Where do these beliefs come from? How are they protected? How do we crack the door open just enough to let in the light? What's going to be effective? It's not enough to be right. How are we going to be effective? And so the piece really helped to profile that we are going to lower our voices. We're going to bring the volume down. We're going to be human beings. We're going to be creatures of goodwill. We're going to expand our tent. We're going to allow people to feel safe. People change their minds from a position of safety. You will never belittle or humiliate someone in a conversation and they go, thank you for belittling and humiliating me. I've now changed my mind and have a better position. It doesn't work that way. People need to feel safe to be able to change their minds. We have to be a steward of that environment. We have to be the adult in the room. And the Al Jazeera English piece really helped to draw a circle around that, that we as a movement, we're evolving, I think, into some better places. And I'm thankful for that.
I think so, too. There's an old adage, people don't care how much you know. They want to know how much you care. And yeah. I think that is a beautiful way for us to end our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining and sharing your thoughts and insights. We've been all over the place, talked about so many things. It's always a joy to talk to you. Can you remind us again how people can find you and your work?
Yeah, sure. If Janice and I were sitting over coffee, it would be midnight probably before we were done, everybody. Like you and I could probably just chat all, like literally we walk so many of the same steps and I think we're so passionate. We've got a lot of years doing what we do and I think we could just go on and on and on. But it's nice to be able to hang out here, you know, to be able to share this space with you. I'm easy to find. The website, which links to everything from the podcast and videos and free thought events that are going on all around the country. The conference circuit's really heating up. That is thethinkingatheist.com. My own personal website, sethandrews.com. And it's got links to a bunch of stuff, my books and the second podcast I host, which is called True Stories. And so thethinkingatheist.com and sethandrews.com, or just Google my name. Something will pop up.
Well, my friend, you are a national treasure. I do believe that. So thank you so much for joining me today. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And I look forward to seeing you all again soon. Take care, everyone.